You are Locked On MLB, your daily MLB podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Hello, baseball fans. Welcome to Locked On MLB, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, where it's your team every day. This is the daily podcast. We talk about all of Major League Baseball, and I'm your host, Paul Francis Sullivan. Please call me Sully. I'm going to be answering some tweets and listening to you, doing a little interaction with you today, and figuring out a couple of topics that have been getting the attention of your pal Sully. This show is available on the free and easy to use Himalaya podcasting app. We're also available wherever you get podcasts. When you get in your car, tell your smart device to play podcasts Locked On MLB, or check out some of the other great shows on the Locked On Podcast Network. It is your team every day. We've got new Pirates podcasts, we got new Marlins podcasts. And hey, let's welcome a brand new podcast for Locked On Red Sox. And we have our new host, Gabrielle, is our new host of Locked On Red Sox. And she's formerly at Girl at the Game, big Red Sox fan. We will have her on the show as well somewhere down the line. Hey, if you want to follow us on Twitter and Instagram, check us out at LockedOnMLB. Lots of great stuff happening there. Good job, Eric. Good job, everyone there. Good job, everyone. David Locke, everyone at Locked On, the Locked On Podcast Network. I'm really proud that we are entering our second year of this. I started this in March of last year, and here we are. Your pal Sully's going to be doing another whole season of Locked On MLB. You can follow me on Twitter at Sully Baseball, Sully Baseball Podcast on Instagram. And please, please, if you want to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, I read the reviews, I love the reviews, and hey, we got what has to be one of my favorite reviews that I've got on Apple Podcast in a long, long time. Osterman, Osterryan. I don't know if I'm pronouncing your name right. Sorry there, buddy. He or she, I actually don't know the gender. The review he wrote was this, and I'm right now confirming everything in this review right now. So this is probably an apt review. It says editorial. One star. I get one star. I'm sorry, but I'm pretty sure he's drunk while doing this podcast. Every time he says I, it could be a drinking game. So there you go. Thanks for the review. I have some positive ones, but I got to tell you something. I just said I right there. So you're probably plastered listening to the show right now. I just did two more I's right there. I humbly apologize. Here's the thing, buddy. Your pal Sully, I don't drink. It's not like I drink just a little bit or social. No, I got drunk one night in 1988. I didn't like the feeling of being drunk, and I haven't been drunk since. I've had probably five alcoholic beverages since Ronald Reagan was in office, and I've had one alcoholic beverage this millennium, and it was on New Year's Day 2000. I had a glass of champagne. I didn't have it at my wedding. I haven't had any other time, not during the Red Sox. Oh, I did do a shot of something after the Red Sox won the World Series because I promised I would. But that's it. So when I'm staggering around here trying to find a topic or trying to go through my words, here's the thing. I'm sober. This is me sober. I want you to really, really think about that for a second. As for me saying I a lot, sorry, it's my podcast. I can do it if I want. Aye. So thanks for the review, though, because I do enjoy listening to the reading the bad reviews as well as the good. And if you're out there and you like it, write me a positive review. And if you've written me a positive review, say hashtag what should I do? Hashtag lobster roll. If write a review on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, whatever it's called right now, or whatever you write your reviews on, write me a review. If you want me to know you written a review, go to Sully Baseball and do hashtag lobster roll, because that's how I roll. Hey, let's talk about a couple of things right now. First of all, I want to address a great tweet that I got from Chatamir Guerrero Jr. at Blue Jay Thoughts. Obviously a big Blue Jay fan. Says, Sully Baseball, only because you said it multiple times in a row, I felt the need to tell you the double L in Castellanos makes a Y sound. R-E Castellanos. Love the show. Thanks a lot. I don't think you're the guy who thought I was drunk. Thanks, Blue Jay Thoughts. Yeah, I have been mispronouncing there you go. I just did it right there. Been mispronouncing his name left and right as he goes to the Cincinnati Reds and brings his bat to what should already be a potent Cincinnati lineup. So thanks a lot. Now I know it's Castellanos. Castellanos. There you go. If I'm making mistakes like that, let me know. I don't want to make mistakes. I want to be corrected. This is how it works. So just let me know. It's Castellanos. Thanks so much. Let's see some other things I could talk about. Oh, here's a great tweet that I got from a friend of mine, Barbara, who's at... Barbara, you know what I think of you. You know I adore you. I don't know how to pronounce your handle. At Feichfem? F-E-I-C-H-F-E-M. Could be a racing thing. She's big... race car person there in Florida. And you know what I think of you, Barbara. But she wrote this in regards to the episode that I dropped the other day, where I basically asked the question, why does everyone do the heavy lifting for owners in terms of complaining about salaries and say, oh, this person makes too much money, or oh, he was offered this, and like, there's always a complaint as if fans are paying the salary, as if it's our money. Why is it always we're favoring the owners in that? And she wrote this good episode about how sports make people somehow desperate to carry water for billionaires. Thank you, Barbara. Ask yourself why every conversation about worst player contracts revolves around players who sign huge deals and not the ones who get hosed. You get it, Barbara. You get it. And that's a great point. Whenever you talk about bad contracts, it's all about bad from the point of view of the owner. Oh, we're paying way too much for this guy. Too many years. It's a bad contract. It's a great contract for the player, isn't it? But you never talk about when a player is getting a deal where it's way below market value and they get a great deal from it. Think about the ways that we discuss it. That's a smart deal. That's a fan-friendly deal. That's a team-friendly deal. Oh, this contract's a disaster, but this one is shrewd. Everything is told from the point of view of the owner getting a deal. Even talking about manipulating service time for Chris Bryant is always with the visage of, oh, they made a smart deal. They get an extra year of control. Control. Bargain. Ooh, bad contract. Gotta eat the money. You don't. You don't at all. But our perspective is always on the side of as if we were the ones having to pay the bills. And you're seeing this as an effective PR marketing move for teams, especially as I mentioned Mookie Betts the other day. You're already seeing Boston fans online going like, oh, he's not worth that, as if they're paying for it. You're going to pay the same amount to watch Red Sox games, whether they sign Mookie Betts or not. They're not lowering any prices, and you're not the one doing it. Even a couple of Red Sox fans who I admire, who are pretty smart, were saying, well, I don't mind him paying him $300 million, but I think $400 million is too much. What are you, the accountant? What do you mean? Do you have the green visor on and the little calculator with the paper ribbon going out of it? Oh, wait a minute. Hold on. Carry the one. No, Mookie Betts isn't worth this. This is also part of the danger of everyone embracing the sabermetrics thing. I know I'm sounding a little get off my lawn here, but it's also like, well, what's the value of him? Well, if we carry the one here, then you could save some money by raising this. Everyone's talking about it as if you're the ones making the decisions, the financial decisions of the team. And you're not. But the way even you speak of, that's a smart contract. That's a dumb contract. That's a bargain. Ooh, that's an overpay. It's always from the point of view. Fans talk about it from the point of view of the owners. And you wind up rooting for the owners. People who want nothing to do with you. Nothing. They want to sit in their luxury boxes. You talk about players not having value. It's like, oh, because you think you can quantify it. Hey, I played baseball. Where's my $10 million contract? You ever think about how much money the owners have? And some of these are the children of the people who made the money. These are the Eric Trumps, okay? I mean, these are the... Maybe I shouldn't have picked a political one. I mean, but come on. You think that Hal and Hank Steinbrenner are people you root for? You want them to do a good job? These are the... Was it the... Ted Knight's kid, Spalding, from Caddyshack. That's essentially who the owner of the team is. These are people who think they're Michael, but really they are hoping to be Fredo. I hope you're understanding my analogies here. That these are the people you're rooting for. You hope they save a couple of bucks? Good Lord. And why everyone sort of subconsciously sides with them is because I think maybe part of it is we all fantasize that we could own a team. Do we? Actually, I don't. I fantasize that I could go back in time and somehow learn a curveball and make it to the majors and maybe get a big contract, maybe get overpaid. But the language that we use is always to favor the ownership. Even, let's take one example everyone brings up every year, is the Bobby Bonilla contract, the Bobby Bonilla Day. And, oh, that's a point of derision about how stupid the Mets were. Oh, every year Bobby Bonilla gets paid another $1 million. Oh, aren't the Mets dumb? Well, first of all, they probably did something smart by deferring the payments as long as they did. One of the things that creates that stigma is that Bobby Bonilla was not terribly successful with the Mets. And then when he arrived with the Mets in 1992, it was really the kind of the official ending of the great run the Mets had. And everyone thought he was going to become a big superstar in New York, and he wasn't. And while he actually did have a couple of decent years with the Mets, he wasn't the star that people thought he was going to be. And by 1995, he was traded away. And there was a lot of bad will about the big contract he signed. And when he made a cameo later of the 99 Mets, he famously was playing cards with Ricky Henderson during the playoff game. And, you know, there was a lot of bad will about him. So he has this aura of being a bust as a player. And the fact that the Mets are still paying him $1 million a year, this and the other thing, is like, man, he was a bust and they're still paying for it. But it was probably a smart move for the Mets to defer the money. But it was an extraordinarily smart move for Bobby Bonilla. Why has it always seemed through the prism of how dumb it was for the Mets instead of how smart it was for Bobby? Bobby Bo, who was not a superstar with the Mets, had some wonderful years with the Pirates, won a World Series ring for his troubles with the Marlins and played in the postseason with a couple other franchises, including the Baltimore Orioles. Had a nice baseball life and gets paid $1 million a year as his career has been over for about 20 years at this point. Why is it seen from the prism of this is dumb money-wise instead of, hey, this is pretty smart for Bobby Bonilla? Ask yourself that. What are you really rooting for? My friend Chris Austin, actually I've never met you, Chris, but I feel like I know you. Big, big fan of the Sully Baseball Podcast, continues to be a fan of Locked On MLB. Wrote, you did a pod on the fact, I don't like to use the word pod, it's a podcast episode. Come on. Come on, Chris. You got your big old beard there rooting for the Reds. I'm doing lots of podcasts about the Reds and you drop pod? I know you're trying to save some characters on Twitter, but let's step it up a little bit. You did a pod, I don't like that term, on the fact that a neighborhood sprung up around a suburban stadium, thoughts of an entire ballpark village springing up, Braves moved just to do that. And basically what this is referring to is, a few years ago I did a thing about the Angels, and that you don't think of them as kind of a neighborhood team like you would think about the like Wrigley Field in the middle of a neighborhood, but the truth of the matter is that it is kind of a neighborhood, dude. There are apartments all around Angel Stadium. You could live in an apartment and walk to the stadium. And there's lots of things. You can live all around there. And they're trying to do, the Angels have bought up a lot of the land around there, so they're not moving anywhere. They're going to stay in Anaheim, and I think that's great. There was a rumor that they may move to Long Beach or something like that, but they're going to stay in Anaheim. And, of course, the Braves moved out of Atlanta and moved out of the site, which was the 1996 Olympics, and have moved north to the, you know, to the suburbs where there's a lot of tech stuff. I've been to some of those suburbs when I worked at a tech company. It is something that I'm all for. I'm all for people living and being able to walk to stadiums. It is a little bit of the inverse of how neighborhood ballparks used to be. They used to have stadiums in the city because that's where the most people were. And they also, that's how they could attract fans. And that there were not giant open tracts of land to build a ballpark. And so the ballpark had to fit within the contours of the city. Which is one reason I find it a little disingenuous when you see teams build stadiums that have things like crooked walls and hills in center field and irregular outfield wall patterns, because that's being done as kind of a artificial quirkiness of a ballpark because people don't like to see symmetrical ballparks. But the truth of the matter is, the reason why Fenway Park was shaped the way it was and Ebbets Field was shaped the way it was and Tiger Stadium is because that's where the streets were around it. You built a ballpark within the streets. You build a ballpark within the neighborhood. You had to jam, you had to shoehorn a ballpark into the neighborhood. One of my favorite details when you look at Old Griffith Stadium in Washington is that there was a little part that kind of jutted in on the outside, because there's some people, there's an area where people wouldn't sell the land to the Senators. So they kind of had to build around this other part, which was, you know, which was, they couldn't buy. I went to Fenway Park all the time as a kid, and you got off the T station, you walked up, and the stadium was built within the streets. That's why the Green Monster's there. It isn't there because, oh, we're trying to create some sort of homey feel. Like, no, that was out of necessity. So it is a little odd to think of it being reversed. There's some wonderful pictures of Anaheim Stadium. That's one of what used to be called Anaheim Stadium when it first opened. And it was this gigantic parking lot. It was a sea of asphalt. And in the middle of it was the stadium. And Anaheim Stadium was quite similar to Dodger Stadium in that it was a revolutionary way to build a stadium, which was, we are not confined by the streets around us. The Dodgers moved from a stadium which was completely defined by the streets around them in Ebbets Field, and eventually moved into a ballpark which was on top of a hill. And the sight lines could be perfect, the walls could be symmetrical, and we had Dodger Stadium, which was the polar opposite of Ebbets Field. And Anaheim Stadium was quite similar to that. So it is interesting that the neighborhood is being dictated by the ballpark now. It's now in reverse. Now, there are so many apartments and so many businesses now around Angel Stadium that didn't exist beforehand that it is a neighborhood stadium. It is. Lots of people live around there. Lots of people could walk to the game. But because the homes and the apartments are dictated by the stadium, it does have a slightly different feel than walking down the street, going to the pub, and turning the corner, and there's Wrigley Field. But do you know what? It's a different kind of world. It's a different type of atmosphere, and a lot of people are going to be moving to Atlanta, the Atlanta area, for Tech World. A lot of jobs are opening up, and business could exist in Orange County. So perhaps that change of dynamic of, yeah, it's a neighborhood park, the park came first and then the neighborhood, it could be an interesting way to live. Do you know who would like to find out? Your pal Sully. I wouldn't mind living in a place where I'm done with work, go back to my apartment, I hear the roar of the crowd saying, I got time. I think I'll walk over to the ballpark. Would it be the same as peeking through the knotholes, like, oh, golly, it's time to go to the game today? But a ballpark can exist with a neighborhood, even if the ballpark came first. Be interesting as a different type of city planning, but I'd like to see how it unfolds. Anyway, if you have anything you want to talk to me about, I'm always willing to talk, so send it to me via Twitter, at Sully Baseball, or on Instagram, Sully Baseball Podcast, or check us out at Lockdown MLB on Instagram and Twitter. And follow us on the free and easy to use Himalaya podcasting app. Well, folks, that's it for January. When you next hear your pal Sully, the Super Bowl will be played. I don't know who's going to win. I don't really care. I'm very rooting for the 49ers, but I'm probably be thinking baseball during the Super Bowl. On the last day of January, that's today, 2020, this is Locked On MLB. I'm your host, Paul Francis Sullivan. Please call me Sully.